This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 14th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Thomas Lewis. Today we're talking television, and joining us from Monocle's studio in Toronto is John Doyle, television critic for the Globe and Mail newspaper. Up for discussion on today's programme, we have the second series of Minnesotan crime saga, Fargo. Will it live up to the success of season one? And a little later in the programme, we'll ponder why North American TV is so paranoid this season, with the introduction of new programmes such as Quantico and Blind Spot. And before the end of the programme, we'll discuss the state of US comedy shows. What will it take to bring people out of their Big Bang Theory and Modern Family comfort zones? That's all to come here on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Thomas Lewis. Do stay with us. Welcome to the programme, John. Thanks as ever for joining us here on the Monocle Arts Review. Well, we're going to kick things off with a look at the new season of Fargo, which premiered last Sunday, the 12th of October. Now, the show is inspired by the Oscar-winning 1996 film directed by the Coen brothers, who, it's worth noting, serve as executive producers on its incarnation on the small screen. Well, before we launch into a discussion on that, let's hear a little taster of season two.
Where's my brother? Are you listening to me? Is he listening to me?
He cut off his ears. He's dead, I think.
I want to be the best me I can be.
We're very friendly people.
I'm not afraid of a war.
Isn't that a minor miracle? That two men could stand on a lonely road and talk. While all around them, people were losing their minds.
Tree. Suppose we ought to get that down.
Well, John Doyle, from that eclectic little taster there of the second season of Fargo, it feels that it's captured something, the spirit of season one that made the TV show so popular on its debut. Give us a quick walkthrough on why season one resonated so much with viewers across the US and further afield, of course.
Well, season one was a surprise to many. The fact that it got made. I think when it was first announced that there would be a series based on the Coen brothers movies, there was a lot of skepticism about, you know, what sort of creative endeavor this would be. It turned out that in the hands of Noah Hawley, the novelist and screenwriter, it was excellent drama, and little wonder that the Coen brothers gave it their stamp of approval. It's roughly the same kind of territory, but it's a different fiction. The strange tone of the Coen brothers movies was kept, but even heightened. There was a sense of the black humor really was at the core of it, and a good deal of violence too. A sense of evil menace in this sort of snow-covered waste in the middle of the U.S. All of it worked. Billy Bob Thornton was wonderful as a central character, this sort of craggy-faced evildoer who drifted into town and unleashed all of these dormant evil impulses among the local characters. The second season, I can tell you, having seen several hours of it, is even better. It's really good.
Well, that is promising stuff. I mean, it's such a hard act to pull off, isn't it? Once a show has premiered to great fanfare, the much-anticipated season two. I just want to talk briefly about the format. Obviously, that's what made season one of Fargo stand out so distinctly in the television crowd, if you like. Just walk us through the format briefly and tell us how that plays out in season two. Is that something they've kept?
Well, it's an anthology series, which means that the second season is completely different in terms of characters and plot, and that works for a series like this. This Fargo is set in the mid-1970s, which is a very particular time in the U.S. Jimmy Carter is president. Ronald Reagan is sort of emerging from the fringes. There is a gas crisis. There's a vague kind of depression at work in the United States. So that setting is important. Again, we're in the snowy wastes of Minnesota. there's a gang war going on, which is, you know, at once comic because it's very small scale. There's a bunch of guys in Kansas City who've decided there's this little territory in Minnesota they can take over. The family that runs this sort of small scale crime racket is not pleased that they're being invaded. And mayhem is unleashed out of this very small scale thing. Again, I think the key to it is what is a form of magic realism, which is brought into the TV version of Fargo. Now, normally we associate magic realism with Latin America, South America, fiction and film, and it's even stranger when it is applied to the dark winter of Minnesota. So you get this strangely shifting tone where strange things happen, unexplained things happen, and there is this sense of menace behind everything. And in the midst of it, you have core characters who are trying to be humane, decent people. That's the core tension, and it works extremely well in this new season.
And you mentioned Billy Bob Thornton in season one as giving an absolutely standout, riveting performance. Are there any performances so far in season two that have struck you, John?
It's little wonder that, you know, the material does, in fact, attract very good actors. In the second season, Ted Danson is in it, and he's really, really good. Kirsten Dunst is also in it, too. I don't think she's ever done any television before. But you can see how the material attracts actors of this caliber, because there's great meat to it, and there's an extraordinary ability to let the material flow. And also it's a challenge to the actors because of the phenomenally shifting tone of it.
Well, let's move on from the second season of Fargo, John, to an area of television in the United States that you've just written a rather fine column on. It seems to be one of the main themes of the season's television offerings in the United States. That's paranoia. It seems that the subliminal message here is that there is no one you can trust, and the public seems to love it. Well, before we discuss some of the prime contenders, John, here, let's have a quick listen to this past Sunday's episode of ABC's Quantico, which continued its puzzle. Here's a little sneak peek.
I'm definitely not letting you out of my sight.
I got a secret.
America's obsessed with Sunday's number one new whodunit drama.
The most dangerous enemy America faces is the enemy within.
Trust no one.
You lied to me this whole time?
Suspect everyone.
You can't outrun the FBI.
Uncover where the truth lies.
From this point on, it's shoot to kill.
Quantico, all new next Sunday at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Well, I was looking over my shoulder just listening to that 30-second clip, John. I don't know about you. Now, your column that you wrote about Quantico and this season's offerings in the US from a drama point of view, a really wonderful opening line. Somebody send in the counsellors, the therapists and caregivers. Maybe bring some warm blankets too. Why has Quantico, John, put a shiver down your spine?
Well, it's a conspiracy thriller. I mean, it calls itself a puzzle, which it is. It's not a show of great depth. I mean, I think I call it high-grade trash, which it is. But it is one of those shows that pitches a level of fear and paranoia at an incredibly high level. It suggests that a major terrorist attack in the United States, in the drama, it's the worst since 9/11, is actually the work of somebody inside the FBI. And that heightens the paranoia about the trust of authorities. Trust no one. Everything, everybody is to be feared, even the authorities, even people who seem reliable and trustworthy, they are not to be trusted. And that theme is picked up in several other dramas too. It's very similar in the NBC show Blind Spot, which had a great pilot, a great opening. A duffel bag is dropped in Times Square in New York, and eventually, when it's opened, a naked woman emerges, covered only in tattoos. She's entirely lost her memory, but the tattoos give a clue as to what kind of conspiracy she was involved in or a victim of. And again, too, it's a puzzle. But again, the level of paranoia or the fear is extraordinarily high. And if you combine it with shows like The Walking Dead and the companion series Fear the Walking Dead, then I think you have a rarely heightened sense of fear and paranoia that is fleshed out in these shows on American television right now.
Well, let's hear a quick snippet from NBC's Blind Spot.
Dr. Borden, this is Supervisory Special Agent Kurt Weller.
Oh, you? Wow.
Do you recognize her?
No. I've never seen that woman before in my life.
Then why is your name tattooed on her back?
Please tell me you know what's going on.
There is no match to your prints or your DNA. Your facial recognition did not find you in any of our databases.
All of her tattoos are brand new. All of them.
You think she might have been special ops?
That explained a few things.
A clip of Blind Spot there, which airs on NBC. Now, the premise for Blind Spot, John Doyle, who's with us in Monocle's Toronto studio, is an absolutely delicious one, I think, when you read it on paper. The reviews, though, have been sort of lukewarm, really, to it, that actually the promise of the plot, if you like, hasn't really been fleshed out. Now, you described, you used the words high-end trash, I think, at the start of this this segment. Do you think that there is value here, this idea of the puzzle of piecing these things together has obviously had some sort of traction in the popular psyche? Do they have some kind of artistic merit too, would you say?
It's questionable as to how much artistic merit there is in shows like Blind Spot and Quantico, but I think, you know, if we are to use mass appeal American television as a sort of compass to get our bearings on what is going on under the surface in the U.S. culture, then we can extrapolate meanings from these kinds of shows. And the first meaning that leaps out is that there is an incredible amount of paranoia, and it's unusually heightened. We've always had, you know, paranoid conspiracy shows that have clicked with the public. You can go back to The X-Files. A more recent show, similar in tone in terms of conspiracy, was Person of Interest. But I haven't seen the fear pitched at quite the same level as it is now. In shows like Quantico and Blind Spot, and also in The Walking Dead, Fear the Walking Dead, The Leftovers on HBO is another show that is drenched in a kind of bleak fear of others, fear of calamity, fear of giant conspiracy, fear of your neighbors, fear of everything. It is very much nobody can be trusted.
Well, from trusting nobody in programs such as Blind Spot and Quantico on ABC and NBC, respectively, John, we'll move to our final topic today, and that is something to, you know, maybe crease the side a little bit. We're going to have a quick look at the state of comedy shows on American television. It seems that the mass appeal for TV comedy is slowly fading away. Well, why is that exactly? It seems that the trend to create something new is to follow TV dramas that went before them instead. Now, John, we've seen a lot of debate, I'm thinking particularly maybe about here in the United Kingdom, about the theatre sector here. Quite a lot of commentary over the past few years when you have record theatre attendances, for example, but that many of the new productions are actually adaptations of things, either books or films or other productions, rather than new ideas being adapted, being made specifically for the stage. Now, is that your sense of TV comedy as well, that actually with a few successes, a few templates that became very successful, actually there's a reticence there to break out and to do something totally new?
Well, in partly an answer, I'd you know, quote the old saw, you know, comedy is hard. It is difficult to create good comedy, especially comedy that does have a wide-ranging mass appeal. And I've noticed that, especially this season, this fall season in the U.S., if you look at the Nielsen's, look at the top 20 shows, then, you know, if you put aside sports programs, then, you know, Fox's drama Empire is number one, and then number two and three you'd usually find Modern Family and Big Bang Theory. These are these are old comedies now. They're kind of on their last legs. And you'd have to go far down the charts to find new comedies making any headway at all. And those comedies that are making some headway, I think, are not so much mass appeal, but they reflect the fractured, splintered nature of the television landscape and the audience these days. These are the comedies that find humor in race, in identity, that kind of thing. Blackish is a very good comedy, which is about a black family. And Fresh Off the Boat is about an Asian family, recent immigrants and adapting to the U.S., and then your comedies that are having an impact tend to be on cable, which is presenting a much harsher, more biting kind of satire. You've got Amy Schumer doing a very feminist kind of, you know, edgy comedy. You've got Louis C.K. with Louis. These are vastly different from network comedies. And I wonder if the days of mass appeal comedies like Friends and Seinfeld and Two and a Half Men are actually over, because there doesn't seem to be a show anymore that has the same kind of appeal at all.
Well, let's hear a quick clip of Blackish then, John, that you mentioned a short while ago.
My name is Andre Johnson. I have a great career, a spectacular house, and a loving family I'm surrounded by every day.
Hey, Pops.
Son, can I just please get a little coffee in me before you start this morning?
But as a black man with all this success, sometimes I feel like an oddity.
If you look to your left, you'll see the mythical and majestic black family.
Lately, I feel in order to make it, we've all dropped a little of our culture.
Oh, my God.
It's important for you to hold on to your culture.
Honestly, the only thing I'm really trying to hold on to right now is my first boob.
You can't be mad at him for that.
That was a clip of Blackish there. There are a couple of good gags in there, John, tucked away, I'd say. You talk about the splintering of our idea of sort of the mass appeal comedy. I wonder what you think that means for the consumer of comedy on television, whichever way you watch it, I suppose, be it on a TV set or on a computer or a tablet or elsewhere. Does this pose a challenge or kind of a golden opportunity for young comic writers who think that they might have a chance of creating something that, if it doesn't become the next Friends, nevertheless, it will gain a strong following in a little pocket of the market elsewhere?
Well, I think really the only challenge is for network executives. I suspect that, you know, some people in Los Angeles at the top of big networks are practically weeping that the mass appeal comedy seems to be dying, because those shows are just so lucrative. They run for years and years. They're syndicated. They can bring in as much as $1 billion over a decade or so. And they're the ones who are challenged by this. I think it is only fair to acknowledge that for a mass audience, and for a black audience, for a Latino audience, they got tired of looking at network comedies that were entirely white people. And if you look at something like Friends, I mean, it was, you know, famously noted that they never seemed to have any black friends. It's fair to the audience that things have splintered and that there are comedies that cater to them. It's simply a matter, I think, for networks of just being sharper about it, just doing better, and acknowledging that while you are not going to get an enormous hit like Friends or Two and a Half Men ever again, you can find a lucrative niche comedy that's not going to be in the top five in the Nielsens, but is going to run forever and ever for a niche audience.
John Doyle, a columnist and TV critic at the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto. Thank you very much for joining us from Monocle Studio in that fine city. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Thomas Lewis. The producers today were Holly Fisher and Carlotta Ribello. Do join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll turn our attention to books. We'll have full reaction to the winner of this year's Man Booker Prize, which is announced on Tuesday evening in London. But for now, from me, Thomas Lewis, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.